Good afternoon. This is Judge Cabranes, accompanied by a phone platform by Judge LaValle and Judge Park. And today's calendar includes two submitted cases, 20-2760, Randall Knight versus Nassau County on submission, and 20-2584, USA versus Sanders, both of whom will be taken on submission. The one case for argument will turn now to United States of America versus Richard Lucas, 19-3937. And before I turn it over to counsel for Sanders, I note that we will try to be deferential on time, although one or another judge may interject a question, but we will give you some additional time if necessary. All right, let's hear from counsel for Sanders.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Robert Singer, and together with attorney Herbert Greenman, we represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Lucas, in this case. Our brief deals with a number of issues, and with the court's permission, I would like to begin and argue the sentencing issue, and then the next issue regarding whether evidence permitted by the district court was inextricably intertwined with the charged offense. Mr. Greenman, with what time is left, would like to argue the search issue. With regard to the sentencing issue and plain error review, judges, we don't believe that focus on factor 3 and 4 of plain error review is important because the government essentially conceded these factors in its brief. And on top of that, we believe this court's decision in Gomez instructed Mr. Lucas prevailed on those two factors. So I'll focus my argument instead on factors 1 and 2. We believe that there was an error in this case because the categorical approach applies and because of two reasons of the changes in the drug schedules. First, since 2015, the New York and the Controlled Substances Act schedules under federal law differ because naloxone was removed from the CSA, making the New York State statute broader. And secondly, and the government doesn't dispute this either, as found in the United States v. Fernandez-Tavares in the Southern District of New York, since 1997, New York has had a broader definition of cocaine because New York criminalizes 3 isomers of cocaine rather than the CSA, which only criminalizes 2. And we believe that there is an error based on 3 circuit courts, the 9th, the 6th, and the 1st, that have reached the same conclusion in that case. In United States v. Batista, Williams, and Abdulaziz, all 3 courts have indicated that there was an error because the way that the court looked at the sentencing factor and the enhancement factor in the guidelines and focusing in on what was going on at the time of the sentence was proper. We also believe that the error is plain in this case. And what we mean by that is that because the error is clear and obvious and not subject to reasonable dispute and not unsettled. First, the most obvious reason is that change that Fernandez-Tavares addresses, which is regarding the 2003 conviction of Mr. Lucas and the 2019 sentencing. At that time, the cocaine differences in definition in New York differed from the CSA definition under federal law, and that should cause us to prevail. And on top of that, it removes any timing argument that the government makes. And with regard to the naloxone change in 2015, again, why the error was plain in this case is because Harbin and this court's decision in Townsend were precedents at that time. Townsend discussed how a quote-unquote controlled substance under 220.16, which is the New York statute Mr. Lucas was convicted on, is controlled by the definition, and narcotic drugs, as defined under 220.16, is a controlled substance as Townsend directed. And since they weren't a categorical match at sentencing in 2019, as a result of that, we should prevail on plain error review. Finally, I know the government cites the Sixth Circuit decision in the United States v. Williams for the proposition that plain error review should fail in this case. But we don't believe it should fail for 3 reasons. First off, the cocaine isomer definitions differed in 2003. That's something that's clear under the law, as we cited in our brief, because of the isomers definitional differences under New York law and the CSA. So even if you use McNeil's time of conviction approach, or if you use Townsend's time of sentencing approach, Mr. Lucas wins on both because there's no categorical match at any time at the 2003 conviction. Finally, as Bautista and Abdulaziz discuss, McNeil does not address whether the ACCA should be using a backward-looking approach when assessing controlled substances offense, which is, of course, what we're looking at here today.
And what about, this is Judge LaValle, I want to ask you, what about the fact that with respect to the different definition of cocaine as to the isomers used, you didn't raise this until your reply brief. What do we make of that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the first point is what I would say is I respectfully disagree with that. We did raise this in a 28-J letter that was published just after our initial brief. So it was before our reply brief. So I believe that we have not raised it in reply only. I believe we raised it before. And the government had an opportunity to address that inside their response, and they did not. So we
but
believe
this
that
is Judge Park. That was an issue you could have raised in the opening brief. It wasn't hooked to a decision that didn't come out. I mean, you weren't unaware of the argument until the 28-J letter, were you?
What I would say, Judge Park, is that we came across this argument when further researching after we submitted our brief on appeal. And that's why we submitted the 28-J letter, which under the rules allow us to do that. And we provided the opportunity for the government to respond back to it in their response brief, since we filed the 28-J letter prior to that. So we don't believe that the issue is waived.
How much prior to the government's date for filing their answering brief?
We filed our initial brief in this case in November 2019, judges. We filed the letter regarding the Fernandez-Tavares decision on January 21st, and the government filed their response to us in this case in February. So they had approximately 2 or 3 weeks.
February what?
I forget the exact. It would have been February 12th, Your Honor. So roughly 3 or 4 weeks had passed since we filed our 28-J letter.
So you're saying the government, if they wanted to, could have asked for more time in any event if they needed it to respond to?
They could have asked for us to file a supplemental brief if they saw fit, but they had the opportunity to reply, whether that was through their response brief or whether that was through another 28-J letter, like we had traded back and forth on several new cases that came out. They had the opportunity, Judge. And so, again, when we look back at this, we believe that when this court applies its relaxed standard to plain error review involving sentencing issues, we believe that Mr. Lucas should prevail. Again, why is a relaxed standard applied in the Second Circuit under United States v. Williams and United States v. Gammas? Because correcting an unpreserved error at sentencing is not as great as the trial context, where, of course, you have to have a new trial. And I know recently—
Sorry, 1 minute left.
As recently as yesterday, Eldridge focused on a supervening change in the law. Again, we believe that there's no supervening change in the law here. And on top of that, Eldridge did not change anything regarding the relaxed standard under sentencing errors on plain error. And we believe the error is plain here too. And the most instructive example is, of course, Judge Wolford, the same district judge who sentenced Mr. Luke in this case, months after the decision on sentence in this case, came to the same conclusion in the United States v. Swinton. Now, with regard
but
to
if it's unsettled under current law, how can it be plain? I'm not understanding. As to the time of sentencing or time of conviction issue, it isn't settled in this court. How can that be plain error? I'm not following that.
Well, Judge, we think it's important because, number one, the change for the cocaine isomers definition was done in 1997. So we don't believe that that change could not be plain to the defense, to the court, to the probation department, to the prosecutors, because it happens.
Right. No, I'm asking about the change in the schedule.
With regard to naloxone, Your Honor?
Correct.
So with regard to that change, again, I go back to what Townsend had said, and that was published in 2018, as well as what Harbin had said, which was published back in 2017, where they looked at these things And they did conclude that not only the categorical approach was appropriate, but there was not a match based on the same reason. And so those cases predate sentencing.
Also, our decision in Doe in the immigration context, which I think is at least arguably in some tension with Townsend, that also seems to make it difficult to find that it was clear, that the law was clear.
And what I would say to that, Judge Park, is that Doe v. Sessions dealt very strictly with the immigration context, as Batista, as Williams, as Abdulaziz, even as Judge Wolford found in Swinton, that was confined purely to that context and that context alone. And so we don't believe the law was settled on that question because, again, it was a very specific finding. And if you look at the statutes that are at play, 3553A, if you take a look at the guidelines at play, as Judge Wolford pointed out under 1B1.111, all of those things focused on the time of sentencing approach for these enhancements, because under this decision, under this court's decision in Alonzo, where the career offender guideline predicates are strictly interpreted, the government's burden to prove these enhancements, as well as the rule of lenity, all of those weigh in favor of finding that this needed to occur, much different than Doe v. Sessions looked at in that particular immigration context. Whereas all courts have said, it was limited to looking back at the conviction at the time of conviction, because that's what the removal context really mattered. I know my time has expired. I'll leave the rest for
Thank you, Mr. Singer. We'll hear from Ms. Gregory for the government.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Catherine Gregory, Assistant U.S. Attorney representing the United States. I want to start with 2 points about that career offender designation. First, the government does not concede either the isomer cocaine issue or that the state and federal drug schedules are no longer comparable. And to the extent that our brief makes note of the divergence, you know, in 2015, we're simply assuming it for the sake of argument because the government believes this is primarily a timing issue. Where this issue is now being raised directly in the district court, the government is explicitly taking the position that these schedules are compatible even after that removal of naloxone in 2015. But secondly, the court
doesn't... What about the isomers? What about the isomers?
Well,
hasn't the state law since the 1990s clearly allowed certain things as cocaine, which federal does not?
No. Respectfully, because Lucas did not raise this issue, the district court was not able to analyze the intricacies of these drug schedules, such as the chemical makeup of positional isomer cocaine or derivative substances or the other complex points of chemistry. And at this point, because he did not raise it, it was not argued. The district court performed no analysis or fact-finding.
Mr. Singer said that they raised in a 28-J letter that the government had at least a few weeks to incorporate into its opposition brief, if not ask for more time.
That's correct. We did have the 28-J. However, the proper forum for a factual inquiry that we believe would be necessary to make that determination would be the district court. And this record, as it stands, is insufficient to argue we would have to introduce potentially affidavits or, you know, expert testimony as to these chemical makeups. And the record is just insufficient at this point. And that's
the matter could be remanded to the district court to do exactly what you say.
Yes. And what I was trying to explain is why we did not do a deep dive into the chemical makeup in response to that 28-J letter. It's just not feasible or appropriate at this stage for us to do what we would need to do, which is why I also bring up that we are raising this argument when the issue is coming up directly in the district courts now. And I believe it's come up in Swinton and another case in front of Judge Wolford. But the court shouldn't reach this issue again, because this is, as Mr. Lucas concedes, plain error review. If we look at the time of conviction versus time of sentencing, when we compare those schedules, the time of conviction is the correct approach for a number of reasons. First, it promotes fairness, notice, due process. A defendant who is convicted in state court would know whether the drug schedules are comparable the day that he is convicted on his state case. He knows that he could face that enhancement before he violates the law, and that's exactly the reasoning the Supreme Court put forth in McNeil. He, as this court put it in Doe, he wouldn't be subject to the fortuities of either his federal sentencing or, for that matter, DEA rulemaking, which, as the court observed in Doe, the DEA has added and removed something like 160 different types of substances over the last 50 years. So while today Mr. Lucas's approach could work in his favor, if in a year or two or 10 these schedules change again and encompass more predicate offenses, he would be right back here arguing that examining the schedules at the time of federal sentencing is unfair. This time of conviction, time of prior conviction approach ensures that defendants know exactly what their status is, good or bad, before they violate the law. This approach also aligns with the objectives of that enhancement. The backwards-looking provision, just like in McNeil, not the same one, but it's concerned with the convictions that have already occurred. So looking at those schedules as they stood at the time of that conviction captures that past offense more accurately than trying to compare a 20-year-old state statute with the DEA's current policies and rulemaking. As this court noted in Doe, it also makes sense categorically because you're looking back at the state statute and corresponding drug schedule then. And although this court, I don't think, has addressed this issue directly, it seems to be in line with the leanings in other criminal cases as recently as this year in McLeod v. United States. This court observed that the district court hadn't considered, quote, whether at the time of his 2000 New York drug conviction, the applicable state's drug statute was more expansive than the corresponding federal schedule, end quote. Now, all of this is to say that even if there was error, despite Doe, despite the Supreme Court's decision in McNeil, it certainly was not plain given all of this precedent. And that's exactly the conclusion the Sixth Circuit came to in that Williams case that we cited in our 28J, where even though it, unfortunately for us, disagreed with the government's suggested approach, it recognized that because of McNeil, because of recent Sixth Circuit precedent, it was not plain. So it still affirmed the sentence in that case. And I believe the concurrence actually argued in favor of the time of conviction approach, citing, among other things, Doe v. Sessions, I believe.
So that would be at odds with. Go ahead, Judge Lavelle.
No, you go. You go. I was going to go ahead.
I was just going to ask, then, you're asking us to create a split with Bautista, the Ninth Circuit. Is that right?
I don't know. The short answer is no, because Bautista doesn't really address McNeil, and it doesn't. The initial Bautista decision didn't even mention McNeil. I think it was 4 months later they issued a revised opinion with two sentences addressing McNeil, and essentially saying, well, sentencing disparities happen all the time, so McNeil doesn't really apply here. I don't think that Bautista really did a deep dive into McNeil or why it's distinguishable from this matter. And I don't know that this court should reach the merits of that issue right now, except to say that even if there was error, it was not plain given the state of the case law. This court is looking at this issue in another pending case, U.S. v. Gibson, which I believe I put in a footnote in our brief, the citation to it. But that was raised in the district court in Gibson, and it's still pending before this court. So that one might be a better vehicle to address this head on. But I believe that Abdulaziz and Bautista get it wrong. They don't do a very thorough job of distinguishing McNeil. And I think Abdulaziz actually addresses Doe v. Sessions and just says, you know, the Second Circuit got it wrong and the Third Circuit misapprehended the law. So it's a very conclusory, I think, rejection of this court's precedent. And I think it's different in the Ninth Circuit because the Second Circuit has this Doe v. Sessions case. It has Townsend. Both of these cases were out before Mr. Lucas was sentenced. And I don't think that you could really say here that the law was clear. If it was that clear, certainly Mr. Lucas would have raised it. And he just didn't. We didn't engage in the analysis either on timing or on the substantive makeup of those drug schedules. So it's now, Mr.
I'd like to ask a question. As I understand your argument, you are relying exclusively on the or primarily on the plain error aspect, and you are not relying on the fact that the defendant didn't raise it in a brief until his reply brief. That in view of the fact that you are leaving us free to deem the argument because it was raised in a 28J letter two, 3 weeks before your brief was due, you are leaving us free to deem it as if it had been raised in the defendant's initial brief.
No, and no. And I want to point out that the 1997 date and isomer cocaine definition were only mentioned, I believe, in the reply brief. But while the case is cited in the 28J letter, it's difficult to respond to that for two reasons, because it's not in the primary brief. It was in the 28J letter, and none of this was substantively addressed below, and it's just so fact-intensive.
So you say that the 28J letter did not mention the isomer difference. The isomer difference had not been mentioned, was not mentioned by the defendant until the reply brief. Is that your statement?
No, I'm looking at the Fernandez Tavares. I'm looking at the 28J letter, and it's talking about the New York Penal Law. Talking about the categorical approach of cocaine sweeping more broadly, and talking about the difference between narcotic drug and cocaine. So I don't see the 1997 definition here. It might have been mentioned because this is a 1998 conviction in the in the case that was cited in the 28J. But again, I would say for both reasons, the court shouldn't address that on the merits because it wasn't raised, and because it was only raised tangentially in the reply in the 28J, and then more in depth in the reply brief.
I'm sorry, one more minute.
And it sounds like also you're making the point that I don't know what a positional isomer of cocaine is, but it sounds like you're saying that whether it's a categorical match depends on some. Facts, science, discovery.
Yeah, exactly, Your Honor. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. And again, you know, we didn't want to do this deep dive into chemistry without the appropriate record, which we think would require things like affidavits from scientists about these positional isomer cocaines. And I myself certainly am not qualified to talk about, you know, what these are or are not. And I believe that this should be a factual inquiry for the district courts, which is what we're doing now in this district, is how we're proceeding. So where this issue is currently coming up, that's where we are arguing about the schedules. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just, as a matter of procedure, I'm a little confused about the procedural posture here. Do we have yet to hear from both sides on the issue of search warrant and the like?
I don't believe the appellant addressed that yet.
That's fine.
Would you like me to address it now?
Yeah, let's have address it. That's okay. And then we can come back to the defense. But while you're up and ready to go, counsel for the government, why don't you address that?
Yes, I believe my time is close to or has expired, so I will try to be brief. The entirety of Mr. Lucas's argument on the motion to suppress seems to be based on disregarding the district court's credibility determinations and accepting his version of the facts. And then
I'm interested in the part about the search warrant for room 113, because I must tell you that I found the government's brief extraordinarily confusing and unhelpful as to the particularly as to what was said to the magistrate who issued the search warrant, in which in many instances your brief characterized it by vague generalizations, like talking about he was told of a relationship between Daniel and Lucas, without saying what he was told, and also that that Lucas was suspected of drug dealing without saying what facts were the basis, and without being precise about what facts in your brief were learned by the government before and known at the time of the presentation to the magistrate, and which were not learned until later. I found it very, very difficult to follow your brief with respect to the timing of what was learned before and what was learned after. So I would like to hear a clear statement from you as to what was the basis of the search warrant for room 113 and whether there should have been a Franks hearing. So if you would proceed to that.
Yes, I apologize to the extent that the brief was unclear, and I will try to clarify now. So from my understanding of Mr. Lucas's argument, it was primarily a fruit of the poisonous tree. So if we look at his brief, I believe around page 50 to 51, he talks about part of it came from the possession of the key in his possession at the time of the arrest, and part of it became the canine hit on the storage locker, I think after the judge issued the warrant. Now, I would defer to Judge Wolford's decision on this in the record, where she discusses why the Franks hearing was not necessary. For example, she analyzed the timeline in much more detail, and she determined that, you know, that as a credibility determination, there was no bad faith here, that
you may want to defer to the magistrate judge. I don't defer to the judge on issues of law. We don't defer to the judge. And it seems to me you're avoiding rather than answering my question. The defendant has made a huge number of arguments seeking to suppress, and some of them are less meritorious than others. And for you to point to arguments that are bad that he made doesn't answer all the arguments. So what I'm asking you is to tell me, what was the probable cause, that what was said to the judge in the issuance to procure the issuance of the search warrants, and what information did the government have at the time, as opposed to information that's cited in your brief that wasn't learned by the government until after that search warrant had been sought and obtained. You speak in a vague way about the issuing magistrate being told about a relationship, that there was a relationship between Daniel and Lucas. What was he told? You speak about the magistrate issuing the warrant being told that Lucas was a suspect with respect to narcotics dealing. What was told about being a suspect? Just saying someone is a suspect is not probable cause. And I think I'm correct in saying that the information obtained by the government with respect to Lucas's acknowledgement of drug dealing in an interview with Agent Wisniewski, that I believe that didn't happen until after the issuance of the search warrant. Am I right or wrong about that? I tried very hard to find the answer from your brief, but had real trouble.
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. I do not know those details at this moment, and I apologize, but I do not want to misstate the record.
Well, it's pretty important. It's pretty important, isn't it? Because if Lucas, as your brief seems at times to imply, if Lucas had already acknowledged that he was engaged in big-time drug dealing and that he had $30,000 to $90,000 in a safe at the Comfort Inn, which were the proceeds of or involved in that drug dealing, it's a pretty easy question that there was plenty of probable cause. But if those things weren't learned until later, when Lucas was interviewed, if it was later that Lucas was interviewed by Agent Wisniewski, then those things don't help at all with respect to the search warrant. I don't understand for the life of me why you don't know which happened first. But
Mr. Lucas's argument, and I'm quoting, is because the dominant reason for the taint of the unlawful arrest should have caused the warrant to fail, because the predominant reason for obtaining the warrant was the seizure of the key, which was in his possession at the time of arrest. So he's arguing verbatim, the taint of the unlawful arrest should have caused the warrant to fail. So that is why our argument, mistakenly, clearly, focused on the lawfulness of the arrest itself.
You're telling me that you simply can't answer, Michael. You can't tell us what what information the government had and communicated to the magistrate in support of obtaining a search warrant for room 113?
At this moment, I cannot, so I would be happy to do it in less than a page and submit it to the court within 24 hours, if that would assist the court. And again, I do apologize.
Well, I don't want it to be in less than a page. I want it to be done in a clear manner that permits us to understand the factual basis for the search warrant.
Yes. And if I'm understanding, Your Honor, correctly, you're looking for the timing of what they knew and when. I believe
well,
that's what
one of the things. That's one of the things that's highly relevant. That if you didn't know stuff until after the issuance of the search warrant, you obviously didn't include that in what you said to the magistrate. And my question also seeks to know, when you say things in your brief like the issuing magistrate of the search warrant was told that. That Lucas was suspected of drug dealing. What was told? What were facts rather than that somebody suspected him? That amounts to nothing. And you say that he was told about a relationship, he or she was told about a relationship between Daniel and Lucas. What was told? What was said? And which is part of the issue about whether a Franks hearing was or wasn't necessary. Were things said in support of the search warrant that simply weren't true or that overinflated the facts that might require a Franks hearing? These yes. are the issues that we face.
Yes, and I believe part of the issue came up because the notes were, Judge Case's notes were not as detailed as one would like. However, I believe that they advised that Dominic Daniels had previously met with Mr. Lucas, who they described him as a known cocaine dealer at room 113. The notes indicate that Dominic Daniels had earlier been arrested for an alleged drug transaction with a bag of cocaine and a key to room number 113. And the agents, I believe,
I think you better put this in writing.
I agree.
It needs to be stated with considerable precision. You also told us, your brief also tells us that I believe it was presented as part of the justification for the search warrant that Daniel was arrested with a key to room 113. But I think it emerged that the fact that Daniels had a key to room 113 was not learned until after the issuance of the search warrant. Whatever is true, I mean, the difference would be significant. If Daniel had a key that was known to be a key card to room 113 at the time he was arrested with a large quantity of cocaine, that would be very important information in support of a search warrant for that room. But if you didn't learn the fact that the key card on Daniel's person was to room 113 until after the issuance of the search warrant, it obviously doesn't support the issuance of the search warrant. And I think we learned that the agents did not learn that key card opened room 113 until, in executing the search warrant, they used it to open the door of that room.
Ms. Gregory, are you there?
Yeah.
This is Jessica Brandt. We have, I think, 15 volumes of the joint appendix, rather unusually large. It is possible, I suppose, that the answer to some or all of Judge LaValle's questions may be found in that voluminous joint appendix. Now, the reason I mention this is simply that when you prepare a response in writing to the panel at the request of Judge LaValle, I think it would be helpful if you could, of course, give us as many appropriate references as possible to the joint appendix volumes that we have at hand. So we would like as much, this is a long way of saying that we need a quite specific response in writing to Judge LaValle's quite appropriate questions.
Of course.
Do we understand, are we in agreement? Let me ask the panel if they have any further questions on what it is that Ms. Gregory is being asked to submit. I think that's right. Okay. Well, this is very good. Let's hear from, and we'll give additional time, of course, to Mr. Singer or Mr. Greenman, whoever it is that is arguing on rebuttal. But we'll give more than 2 minutes. We'll give six minutes of rebuttal. 6 minutes of rebuttal for Messrs. Greenman and Singer.
Your Honor, I'm Mr. Greenman, and I'm just going to talk briefly about the search issues which Judge LaValle just raised. What happened here was that the police, when they went to Judge Case, who's a county court judge, chose, rather than putting information in an affidavit, they chose to go what we call in camera, which is a procedure used in state court, and before the judge, and to provide information. The state law requires Judge Case to make basically detailed notes about the conversation that he had. And the conversations that he wrote down were untrue, and I don't mean that by Judge Case. The information provided to Judge Case was clearly untrue. There was information that that the police knew that Daniels had gone to room 113. They didn't know that. There was information that he had met Mr. Lucas at the hotel. Mr. Lucas was never even at the hotel until he was outside in the parking lot. And it went on from there. And Judge LaValle asked some information about the key that was taken from Daniels. Testimony at the suppression hearing clearly showed that there was no number on that key that was taken from Dominic Daniels. The key, the government did not put the key in evidence, but questions were asked of the officer about what was on the key. And the testimony was that they found a key card, but there was no number, there was no room number on the key card. So our argument with respect to the search warrant, Your Honors, was not simplistic, as the government is saying, simply arguing that there was a taint and there was no attenuation. Sure, that is part of the argument that we made, but we clearly argued that the information provided to Judge Case was false in any way you looked at it, and we asked the court to conduct a Franks hearing, which the district court refused to conduct that Franks hearing, even though to us it seemed that there was information that was false. We believe, Your Honor, that the search warrant was executed prior to the time that Agents Wisniewski and Webb had finished talking with our client over at the Sheriff's Department headquarters. So they had already gone over, they had relied on, seemed like, fabricated information, certainly untrue information, and there's no doubt but that Judge Case relied on that information. Can't take it away.
Can you, counsel, answer a question that I was asking your adversary as to the time relationship between the application for the search warrant and the interview by the federal agent of Lucas, at which Lucas admitted to substantial narcotics dealings? Did that interview happen before or after the application for the search warrant?
Your Honor, it's our recollection, and I just talking with Mr. Singer about it for a couple of seconds. It's our recollection that the search warrant took place before the information was gleaned from the conversation or the interview with Mr. Lucas at the sheriff's office. And it's clear
because if the information given by Lucas to the agents in that interview about his own dealings in narcotics, which included his mention of a substantial amount of money in the safe in the Comfort Inn, that clearly would have given an adequate basis for probable cause for the issuance of a search warrant for the search of the room. But if that information was not acquired until later, it obviously didn't serve in any way to support the issuance of a search warrant.
Yes, Your Honor. And I agree, Your Honor, that if it had been learned, the government could argue that it could have provided probable cause. Problem was, it was never provided to Judge Case So if you look at the four corners, I hate to be our case. I'm a little old, Your Honor. I talk about old cases. But if you look at the four corners of the search warrant, including the in-camera notes of Judge Case, that information was never provided to him. So whether or not it was later or before, and we believe that the warrant was executed before the conversation took place over or was completed over at Sheriff's headquarters. Number one, we believe it was before. It was executed prior to. The search warrant was obtained prior to that. But number two, even if the information was known to the police officers as a result of the conversation, it was never made known to Judge Case. And with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't believe that that information could be considered at this point in time because the judge was never provided with that information. And again, under U.S. versus Ventresca, you have to look at the four corners of the warrant and can't go outside the four corners of the warrant. So either way, I think, Your Honor, our position is correct. So our position is not simply that there is a taint. We believe that there is a taint here based upon what took place in the parking lot. But separate and apart from that, Your Honor, there were strong issues that were raised relative to our request for a Franks hearing, and the hearing was denied by the court.
And tell us again, what was the information revealed in the issuing judge's notes that was false?
It indicated in the notes, Your Honor, that Dominic Daniels had gone to room 113. They didn't know that. They indicated that they had met with Mr. Lucas at room 113. That never happened. They indicated that he had purchased cocaine from Mr. Lucas at room 113. None of that was true, Your Honor. None of that information was true. And that was important because that was the nexus that they tried to give to try to show that room 113, that they could find some contraband or something of interest or evidence at that room, when in fact the information provided, which created the nexus to room 113, did not exist.
Well, it seems to me that if Judge Cabranes agrees that you should have the opportunity to respond to the information, to the documents submitted by the government, answering the questions that I put.
Yes, let me perhaps circle around, as is now said, to give a schedule to the government and counsel. Ms. Gregory, as I noted, we have 15 volumes of the joint appendix, and it is possible that the answer to some or all of these questions may be found in those 15 volumes. But in any event, the government supplemental letter brief of no more than 15 double-spaced pages will be due by no later than Monday, June 28th at 12 noon to respond to the questions of fact raised by Judge LaValle and perhaps to the related question of whether a Franks hearing before the district court would be appropriate or necessary. Defense counsel shall have a comparable opportunity to submit a response to the government's supplemental submission, that is a maximum of 15 double-spaced pages, by no later than Thursday, July 2, 2021, at 12 noon. And let me add a bit of advice or guidance with respect to these submissions, which are important to all three of us. I encourage both sides to rely on the material in the joint appendix of 15 volumes to the extent possible. But of course, we will welcome any other relevant or probative evidence or citations to authority. So are there any questions, Ms. Gregory, of what we expect?
No, Your Honor.
That's fine. And then defense counsel, any questions about our expectations?
No, thank you, Your Honor. We appreciate that.
That's fine. And of course, in the nature of things, these letters will presumably have suggestions about how the case should be disposed of when we when we take it under submission, and we will be taking it under submission as of July 2, 2021. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll otherwise reserve decision, and I ask the clerk to close court.
Court stands.